Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are switching gears. We are leaving Baltimore County and talking about global politics and talking about American policy and strategy in the global world, in the world globally. We're focusing on the Middle East because clearly that is going to be the centerpiece, I think, of a lot of foreign policy issues. It is you're watching what's happening in Egypt with secular forces and people who support the Brotherhood, Islamists who are battling in the streets of Cairo. You see the same tension happening in Morocco. You see a very confused situation in Syria for many people. People do not put their hands around it. Most people do not like Assad as a dictator. But there's a lot of mixed feeling on the ground in Syria that we don't talk about, with a lot of Syrians, especially Christian Syrians, Alawites, many Shiites who support the government for their own reasons, others who do not. There's the question of al-Qaeda kind of groups that are in the mix in Syria. The United States wants to call them terrorist groups and only support the other. Is that viable or not? And this is something we're going to have to – and then there's Israel in the midst of it all, which is going to have a much more right-wing nationalist government in this next election than it even has now. And all that kind of plays into what's going to happen. We are joined here by
anyone's out there, I'm getting something in my ear.
Okay. Can we get that? Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, good. So we are here with in studio Dr. Adil Shamu, Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and Foreign Policy and Focus, where he's an associate editor. Dr. Bilal Saab is with us, who is Executive Director and Head of Research at the Institute for Near East and Gulf Military Analysis North America. Sam Faddis, retired CIA officer and author. James Phillips, Senior Research Fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. And welcome all. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you hear okay, James?
I have something I don't know what it is. It's some kind of broadcast or a tape that keeps going over and over in the background.
The phone system here, we'll try to get that fixed, and they're working on it now. So hopefully if it doesn't bother you too much, we'll get that out of the way. And folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. All of our guests lined up. I can't see on the screen, but we'll just begin. So this is a very tricky situation. Let's just begin with Syria for a moment. And we'll move into Egypt. The situation in Syria is clearly, and I can hear the same thing going on. So there is something happening in the phones there. That in Syria, this is not as simple an equation as many would want in terms of what American policy should be. Let's just start there. We're hearing the American policy saying we are only going to support certain freedom fighters in certain part of the resistance in Syria, not the whole resistance. But you can't get away from the fact that a lot of the forces that are the most organized right now in Syria are those allied with the old al-Qaeda forces in Iraq that have come back across the border into Syria. So what do we think about that? Sam, let me begin with you.
Yeah. I think everybody agrees that Assad is a monster and he wants to go. But I mean, we want him to go. But this situation, like so many of the others we've seen, gets really messy. I mean, we don't get to choose who overthrows him. Particularly in this case, we don't really have hands on. We're not directly involved with what's going on. So you wish that the answer was that he goes and he must be replaced by something better. Unfortunately, particularly in the Middle East, it doesn't always work that way, right? He can go, and what replaces him can be just as bad and even messier.
And you use the word better. And the question is, what does better even mean? I mean, and what do we – this is something the U.S. thinks in some ways, the West thinks in some ways, Adil Shamu, that they can define. The question is, can the West define this?
Well, it's really – we are American-centric, unfortunately, in most of our discussions. And it's better for us. I mean, look what the Obama administration has done. They formed this national coalition of Syrian revolutionary and opposition forces in a meeting in Qatar. And then we announced that one of the groups, we call them terrorists. Okay? So we are already splitting the Syrians into those who are with us and those who are against us, and we're calling them terrorists. The minute you call them terrorists, that means you cannot join them, you cannot have a discussion with them, you cannot take their views into consideration. And this is really a dark alley we all the time go into, and then we are stuck. We choose to go after
One second. I think, all right. Sorry about that.
We choose the path into regime change. We find Saddam Hussein. We find now Assad. And then, of course, we have Ahmadinejad in the wings waiting for us to chop his head. And then we define our interest as if it's the interest of the people. Remember, we defined it in Iraq by Ahmad Chalabi. He had only 600 votes, the people who went with him. So it's really very dangerous for us to go, even in troops. Plus, we have to be principled. Are we going there for the Syrian people, or are we going there for the sake of France, United States, Great Britain, and Israel?
Bilal, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us. Your thoughts on this before we come into more specifics. Okay, we're going to have to call our guest back, and let me see if we can get James. Can you get through?
Hello.
Hi, James.
Hi.
So, sorry about the phone situation. We're trying to resolve that now. But we'll bring Bilal right back in. So you heard what Adil was saying and what Sam was saying earlier. James?
Oh, yes.
I'm saying you heard what Sam was saying and what Adil was saying earlier.
I heard the beginning of it, but then it kind of fuzzes over. But
I'm sorry.
From what I heard, I would agree that, you know, we should be clear that anything we do should be for U.S. national interests. And I think if we take an overly idealistic view of what we can accomplish in Syria, we will inevitably be disappointed. And I think that, at least in Iraq, we could argue that it was hard to imagine anything worse than Saddam Hussein. And it was difficult for Westerners to imagine something worse than Saddam. But when he was gone, the very ruthless groups that emerged out of the woodwork to slaughter each other left many Iraqis wishing that Saddam was back in power, and that is, I think, the real tragedy.
I've heard a lot of people. Bilal Saab, are you there now?
I can hear you now, Mark.
Great, yeah. Perfect. Thank you, Bilal. Good to have you with us. I've heard a lot of people from Baghdad in Iraq say to me, it is worse now in Baghdad than it's been, and I said, what, 50 years? He said, no, 500 years. But whatever that is. That's a sentiment. So I'm curious, again, with what you've heard the other guests say so far, your analysis.
Is this a question from you, Mark?
It is, Bilal.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show again.
Great to have you on.
I'm sorry I missed the first part of the conversation.
I'm sorry about that, too.
Are conditions now absolutely disastrous in Syria and similar to what we witnessed after the invasion of Iraq in 2003? Absolutely. I talk to a lot of Syrians on a regular basis, and you hear about the atrocities and the horrors in the news, but for folks who are actually living inside the country and them telling the stories of what's happening, it's just beyond inhumane what the Syrian government is doing to its people. Your guests were mentioning what U.S. interests are at this point and what the U.S. can do to prevent the worst from happening. If there is one coherent statement coming out of Washington regarding Syria, it is that very famous red line that the president has repeated three times and his secretary of state has mentioned a couple of times now, which is the usage of chemical weapons. Just very briefly, let me just mention that it is quite tragic that it came down to this. I mean, all the horrors perpetrated by this government against the rebels and the civilians alike since March of last year were not enough to capture the serious attention of Washington. It took the threat of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad possibly gassing his own people for someone in the White House to finally listen. I mean, that the story of 22 million people fighting tyranny and risking everything to pursue freedom and a better life has been overlooked until now is really disappointing as far as the United States is concerned.
Go ahead, Adil.
But the question is, and this is where I want a clear futuristic estimates. What does interference by United States and France and England and NATO in Syria would mean? We are already chopped the Syrian population into half, half with us and half against us. That is not a good recipe for sort of coalition and unity of the people against Assad. That's division of opposition forces already. There will be no democracy because we are not going to, we, the one we are helping them, we are not going to allow for democracy to flourish because we're going to ban half of the population from exercising their rights because we have designated them by American know-how in Washington, D.C., that they're terrorists or terrorist-linked or terrorist-inspired, any of these definitions they could use. And that is not a recipe other than for civil war like it happened in Iraq. I really fear Syria is going to be worse than Iraq and it's going to spread if our foot soldiers enter or any foot soldier from Britain or France enter Syria.
And James Phillips, I mean, some people would argue that what's happening in Syria, with or without Western intervention, will be worse than Iraq, that things will just implode.
Yes.
Mark, if I could just clearly define what I meant by intervention.
I'm sorry. I think, is that James and Bilal trying to say it at the same time? Let me start with James and go to Bilal. Go ahead, James.
Okay. I think as bad as Assad is, he has a long way to go before he kills the same number of people that Saddam Hussein is. Saddam Hussein is responsible to have killed with his invasion of Iran, his invasion of Kuwait, his use of chemical weapons against his own people, driving more than a million Iraqis out of the country. And I think at last count, there were 300,000 bodies found in mass graves inside Iraq. And as I understand it, so far in this latest uprising in Syria, there's probably close to 45,000 people dead. But the last uprising, or one of the last uprisings back in the early 80s, there was 20 to 25,000 killed. So it is a horrible, brutal dictatorship that's responsible for the situation in Syria, but it still has a long way to go to get to the point where Saddam Hussein was. And yet, the U.S. Intervened to overthrow Saddam and didn't get a lot of gratitude, which is understandable, not only from Iraqis, but I don't think really got the Bush administration got the same humanitarian credits for overthrowing one of the worst dictators of the last century.
I know you want to jump in right now, but let me just go to Bilal Saab first. But Bilal, go ahead.
Mark, I just wanted to mention a few things about U.S. policy, and I completely agree with every speaker regarding the limited nature of what the United States can do to shape the course of this conflict. But here's what it still should do, and that is basically studying carefully and preparing for and doing its utmost to prevent the absolute worst. And in my mind, the absolute worst, ironically, I know that's not very popular to say, it is not the usage or movement of chemical weapons. The three far more threatening scenarios that could materialize as the noose around Assad's neck tightens are three things. First one, and we mentioned it already, which is a total Iraq-style collapse of order in Syria and a civil war that doesn't stay inside Syria, that spills over absolutely furiously to Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, Turkey, igniting sectarian and ethnic conflict, you know, in the surrounding neighborhood. That's one scenario that the United States should work very hard to try to contain or avoid. I know that there are no boots on the ground, but the United States has allies in the region, and it should work closely with them to try to prevent that scenario. The second one is that, you know, Assad does not have many exit strategies, and so one of the ways he could go down, and we all know he's going to fall hard, it's just too late for soft landings, he's going to try to perhaps launch a war basically against Turkey or Israel in an attempt to regionalize the conflict, you know, try to open multiple military fronts and, you know, try to push his friendly powers, including the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, even non-state actors, Hamas and Hezbollah, to intervene on his side. He's going to push them to make that decision. I know it sounds like suicide, but think of it, it's far from irrational. This is one of his exit strategies. The United States should work hard to try to prevent him from doing that. And the third one, which is unfortunately already materializing, which is the control by a terrorist group, an al-Qaeda movement such as Jabhat al-Nusra, of strategic territory, you know, containing a missile base or a chemical site. The organization could come back to the region after all the hard hits that it has suffered over the years. It could set up shop in the country in an effort to build a regional franchise. And like I said, it's not unlikely. Jabhat al-Nusra is already quite a potent force in the conflict. It's got hundreds of recruits and quite a nice budget supplied by regional actors in the Arab Gulf states. So these three scenarios are far more threatening to me, and they should be far more threatening to the United States' interests in the region than Assad using chemical weapons.
Sam Faddis, before I go back to Adil, I'd like you to jump in here because you have had your boots on the ground, so to speak. Talk about what you've heard and how you think that that any Western nation can really respond to Syria at the moment.
Well, I don't think there's any easy answers in Syria, like, as everybody has talked about. I mean, this is a mess, and it's a question of some very difficult choices. But as you noted, I mean, in the Iraq situation, when we went into Iraq well in advance of the invasion, leaving aside whether we should have been there at all and the justification, I mean, that put us in a position where we, at least early on, really had our hands on the controls of what was going on. You know, in this situation where we're sitting on the sidelines watching, we're really not going to have a lot of leverage. And, you know, the other observation I would throw in is when you're a bunch of guys who have spent months and years fighting and scraping to bring down the Assad camp, the regime, and we have not assisted, one wonders what your attitude is going to be toward the United States when you finally come out on top of the heap. That's not necessarily me saying that we should jump in wholeheartedly tomorrow. I'm just saying we have to understand that we can't show up the day after this is all over and expect that everybody's going to do exactly what we want when we have kind of been noticeably absent for the duration of the conflict.
Adil, go ahead.
Well, if we look at the pro-intervention people, especially like Lindsey Graham, Senator McCain, and Joe Lieberman, they wanted to intervene within the first week of conflict in Syria. The same thing, the same logic and reason when they wanted to invade Iraq. 10 years before they invaded Iraq, the neoconservatives wanted to invade Iraq because of many reasons. We all know what they are. But so why do I have to take those seriously? To be very honest also, we are intervening. We have operational forces, southern Turkey right at the border. They have a protection by the NATO member. And intelligence services of the French and the Brits and the Israelis and ours are scouting already Damascus to see how we could deploy forces there in case we need to go there. So we have interfered in the affair of Syria day one, basically. And that is really unfortunate. Why the United States feel compelled to all the time, despite the Arab Spring, that we're going to intervene not to get rid of a dictator, which I will support, if that was the only reason we are going. We're going to make submissive states to our will, like we have tried to do in Iraq and elsewhere, and like in Libya, for example. That is, to me, a recipe for long-range disaster for us. People in this day and age of internet and communication, they are not ignorant of why we intervened and whose benefit it is, whether it's in Libya, where the oil companies now, the Western oil companies have all the contract, or in Iraq, the Western and especially U.S. oil companies have the contract. And people will understand that, and there will be all movement and rebellion against us in the long run. This is not the way to go. We need to treat equally to us those Arab countries and their people, whether they're in Egypt or in Iraq or in Syria or in Lebanon.
So what I want to do, we have to take a brief break, just a couple minutes. because we're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back with all four of our guests and really wrestle with what we think could be the outcome in Syria, in Egypt, especially those two countries. I think earlier, Bilal Saab mentioned that this could spill over. Now, we thought this could happen in Lebanon before. We thought it could spill over from Iraq. We've heard the spillover theory before, but now more than ever, with Syria falling apart, this really could happen.
Yes.
And with Egypt in the midst of a battle between secularists and Islamists in the streets. And that's a divide happening throughout, especially the urban Muslim and Arab world. So, especially the Muslim or Arab world, I should say. So we're going to come wrestle with that when we come back with our four guests. And we'll get to these calls coming in at 410-319-8888. Ernest being the first caller up, we'll get your calls on others in. Stay with us. We'll be right back to continue this discussion. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are here with Dr. Adil Shamu, Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and Associate Editor of Foreign Policy in Focus. Bilal Saab, who is Executive Director and Head of Research at the Institute for the Near East and Gulf Military Analysis North America. Sam Faddis, Charles Faddis, is an author. His books are all over our website. Retired CIA officer. And James Phillips, Senior Research Fellow for the Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. And you at 410-319-8888, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We will get you on the air in just a minute. But let me throw out what we were talking a little bit about at the end of this and in the overarching question here. We've seen 30 years, 50 years of dictators throughout the Middle East and the U.S. backing dictatorships, the West backing dictatorships in the Middle East. And many would say now this Arab Spring, which is the result of a really in some ways part of it, of educated younger people with nowhere else to go, young people with no jobs, who are saying enough is enough, that erupting to say there has to be a change in their own nations. And those changes range from people who see themselves as secular Democrats, who are very kind of whose way of life is both nationalist and Middle Eastern and Western, and those who are Islamist of one degree or another, modern Islamist, to very fundamentalist Salafis. And there's a huge spectrum of people out there. But they're all erupting in one level or another. And some people are very tied to regimes, like you saw in Iraq. The Ba'ath Party was very tied to Saddam and holding on to that. And you took a nation where 70% of all the marriages in Baghdad cross Sunni-Shia lines to eruptions of Sunnis and Shias killing each other. You see what's happening in Syria. We see what's happening in the streets of Egypt. You see now with the king of Morocco still holding power, even though they allegedly have this democracy that really has no power inside of Morocco. The Libya, which is still in chaos in many ways. So, as I said earlier, this is so hard for people, I think, analysts in the West, to put their hands around, because nobody expected this to happen. And nobody can really figure out how all these parts are going to work. These parts are being fueled by many places. I mean, there's guns coming into Syria from Iraq. The Iraqi al-Qaeda groups who are multinational are now in Syria. Many of them are Syrian, with battle-hardened in the middle of this. This is a very complex situation. Let me leave it there and talk about this complexity. And what this all means, Bilal Saab, you can start.
You know, this historic conundrum, policy conundrum of the United States in the Middle East, basically pursuing security interests, which by default often happen to be at the expense of championing democratic aspirations of the people of the Middle East. This conundrum, unfortunately, is not going to end with the departure of Mubarak in Egypt, Gaddafi in Libya, Ben Ali in Tunisia, and soon others. I mean, this remains a huge challenge. And this challenge could not be more visible and pronounced than in Egypt. Let me just give you the example of Egypt just to illustrate my point. People are now debating in Washington whether the United States should continue to provide, you know, aid to Egypt now that the Muslim Brotherhood is in charge. I mean, those who argue that, you know, U.S. aid should flow unconditionally. And those who say that we have no business giving taxpayer money to government whose agents we don't share our own values, right? Now, let's be real. U.S. aid to Egypt is not going to stop or decrease by a single dime. But for some stupid reason, it does. And you know, anything is possible with the United States Congress. Rest assured that it would signal the death of the U.S.-Egyptian relationship. The United States may be annoyed with the Egyptian government's trajectory, right? And let's call them less than democratic practices with Morsi at the helm. Mm-hmm. But letting Egypt become a failed state or an enemy of Israel is also not an option. So you're still with that same challenge that the United States has failed in the past and in the present. Can we pursue our security interests and at the same time respect and champion the democratic aspirations of the people of the Middle East? That problem is not going anywhere.
So, but Adil, and then we'll go around the table, go to Adil and Sam and James. But how do you define what that means, our security interests? Are our security interests in the interests of the Middle East, the Middle Eastern nations? Do we define it solely by what we think are our security interests, or how even they defined? I mean, are they defined by Morsi? Are they defined by what started out as Nasser through Mubarak? I mean, in any other nation we can name, what does that mean?
Unfortunately, our interests have been defined in the short term, prior to Obama, and unfortunately, all our hopes was that Obama will define them, especially after facing the Arab Spring, in long-range terms. If we're talking about our security in short term, yes, we have to have basically compliant leaders, whether it's Morsi or al-Maliki or King of Jordan or the Saudis or the Libyan government, etc. Or we should allow the process of the Arab Spring and revolution all across the Arab world. It may take a decade or two, and we just muddle through it, basically, without interference. I think in the long run, our security will be strengthened. And the Arabs, as they are going through this horrible but good transition, they will be our friends because they will see that we stood with them, that we stood for their interests and not just our oil interest and our interest with Israel, because our long-range interest will be is to have these millions of people and hundreds of millions of people and 1.7 billion Muslims. They look at us and respect us because we respected them and respected their interests. Revolutions or Arab Spring is not going to be available for final results like we want in the 24-hour cable channels. We have to have a resolution in about 24-hour or 48-hour. That's unfortunately our patience. But I was hoping Obama will go through that, and he's not. All his methods and means and outlook is no different than the previous administrations in some aspects.
But Sam Fadison, pick up from that. I mean, how does America even show that?
Say again, Mark.
How does America even show that? What does it mean to show that you're allied with the Arab world? What does that mean?
Yeah, I don't know, and I think you know, trying to define our foreign policy in terms of sort of hoping that people are going to like us, I don't think is going to take us very far. And I don't say that trying to be caustic. I mean, I think that, you know, we've decided to call this the Arab Spring. The press is in love with viewing this as, you know, a rise of secular humanism in the Middle East, and everybody wants to have a liberal democratic government. I think your description was a lot more accurate. It's messy. It's convoluted. It's a boiling pot driven largely by economic concerns and frustration, and you've got people all across the spectrum, and it is going to be a mess for a really, really long time. So I think one of the other guests, I apologize for not remember which one, indicated earlier that we should keep a real sharp focus on our own national interest, and I think that is unfortunately the way we have to pursue this.
That was Bilal Saab.
If we're going to get involved, we ought to be able to define what it is for the United States that is so important that we get involved. And I know that sounds really harsh and cold-blooded, but I think that's the reality.
But I'm proposing not get involved. That's exactly the opposite. I'm suggesting not get involved on daily basis for promoting only our interest. The people of the Arab world have their own interest.
Go ahead. James Phillips, why don't you pick up on that, and then we have a question. We'll go to the phones. We don't have our... All right, we're going to... These bloody phones. So we'll see if we can get them... Are we back up yet? All right. No, I guess not. So we'll try to get... So guys, hang on. We have to call you back, but otherwise, hold on. We're going to try to get these phones back in gear. A listener who happens also to be... was a correspondent in Egypt, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon for NPR for years. Sunni Khalid, who speaks Arabic and is one of the best foreign correspondents I think public radio ever had, and war correspondents they ever had.
Yeah, I met him.
He was a brave and brilliant guy. He said, ask them if the Egyptian military may be compelled to intervene to save Egypt from anarchy. Three activists told me, the situation gets worse over a couple of weeks. Many people would welcome the return to military rule. Now, that is a reality.
Yeah. I was just interviewed last week on Russia Today, and I said the situation is very dangerous. And then he came back at me, what do you mean by dangerous? And I said, there's a history in Middle East of the military coming and cleaning the decks because they think they are the savior. And I wouldn't be surprised if the military is manipulating Morsi into a position where they have to clean up the deck. That is my worst fear, because I think there will be civil war in Egypt if that happens.
And James Phillips, that could be reality.
Yeah, I think that very well could happen in Egypt. And I think that's one reason why... we argue that we should look towards freedom rather than just towards self-defined democracy.
Can I ask you a question, Michael James? I'm only interrupting. I want to know in terms of the reality of on the ground, what does that mean? Describe what that would mean in terms of any policy. What does that mean?
That we should support political groups that favor freedom for people rather than groups that claim they're democratic and then once they're voted in start clamping down on people's rights, on religious freedom, on freedom of speech, on freedom of assembly, on political freedom. And that also, I think one thing that's gotten very short shrift in the Arab Spring is the need for economic freedom. And when Mohamed Bonesa lit himself on fire in Tunisia, it was because he was protesting against police that were confiscating his goods and his preventing him from making a livelihood, and that should be a very important part of addressing the problems of these societies going forward.
I would agree with you if we support those groups, but without interfering in their affair, sending arms to certain groups and sending money into certain groups and trying to undermine other groups. It's a messy. It's going to take a decade. But let the people of the region resolve their differences, not with interfering from Western nations or any nation.
Bilal,
Mark, if I could just
go ahead, Bilal.
Well. One of your guests, I guess, mentioned the prospect of a civil war in Egypt. I just don't see that, quite frankly. But I am. That doesn't mean I'm not concerned about the course of democracy in that country. I think that what is happening today in Egypt, first of all, there's a heated debate. And that's very normal, and it's a good thing for countries undergoing political transitions. Of course, let's hope that the conversation in Egypt stays civilized and it doesn't lead to violence and instability. The problem is that the debate needs rules, it needs laws, and it needs some regulations. I mean, keep in mind that there's no constitution today. There's no parliament because the military dissolved it back in June at the recommendation of the country's highest courts. The country today is deeply vulnerable to the whims and actions of incompetent generals in the past, not so distant past, and now authoritarian and power-hungry Islamists. I mean, if I could just describe Egypt's Islamists today. They're like a fat kid, right, who was forced by his parents to go on a diet for a very long time. Then all of a sudden his parents pass away in an accident or they disappear for some reason. And so what do you expect that kid to do all of a sudden? Of course, you're going to go eat all the cakes he wants. And that's the story with Egypt's Islamists. They've been excluded for a very long time from the political process. And so what do you expect them to do? They're power hungry. But they just faced a reality check. That reality check is that half the country does not agree with them. The problem with the liberals is that they're very disorganized. And they're also depressed. And they're even skeptical that the United States helped Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood win the presidency because, for some reason, they think that Washington can do business with this new guy. Of course, this is rubbish. But that is the thinking of many liberals inside Egypt today.
So let's try to get a call in here. We haven't brought them in because the phones have been so crazy. But let's give it a whirl. 410-319-8888. And we have to keep the questions kind of short just because of the phone situation. Ernest, you're on the air.
Good evening to you and your guests. Good evening to you and your guests.
Welcome.
Now, the op-ed in the Sun paper on November the 30th, a mess made in the United States, our Middle East meddling. And that's what it is. Now, the first person they took down, the thing that they all have in common are these countries that are having these disturbances, except for Egypt. They all showed support of the Palestinian problem and how they're being persecuted and murdered. Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi, and the president of Syria. So they have gone. But the thing is that it was in 2008, a judge, a Zionist, a Jewish person, Ashkenazi Jew, said that was a war crime.
Right.
Now, how can, and they just had another war crime there where they bombed all those people over there. Now, how can you be concerned about some Arab people and not be concerned about other Arab people? They bombed Libya for 6 weeks and armed the people in Benghazi, the same people that fought in Iraq and Afghanistan against the American troops. And Al-Qaeda was involved in that, some of the troops, and now they're still fighting in Libya. And everybody in Syria does not want Bashar, or whatever his name is, Assad, to give up because they have Alawites, Kurds, Christians. They say that if he loses, they're going to be killed. So the problem is to get the Ashkenazi people back to the 67 borders and a two-state solution, and then the Arab people will have some confidence in us. United States have killed more Arabs and Muslims than Saddam Hussein ever. So that and in the first invasion.
Okay, so I'm sorry, Ernest.
Let me finish up, but Mark.
Ernest, we only have a short amount of time. I'm sorry.
Well, you've been talking all day. I know it's your show.
Yeah, it is, and so you have. I give you another 30 seconds, and I have to go on.
Okay, in the first invasion of Iraq, April Glaspie told him it was all right when he went into Kuwait, and they invaded him then. And then the second invasion of Saddam Hussein was weapons of mass destruction, and the neocons and the Zionists got together and said, "We know it's no weapons of mass destruction, but we're going to invade him anyway." And he was an enemy to Osama bin Laden. So how and even Gaddafi was an enemy to Osama bin Laden and what's it called? But the neocons.
Okay, so James, we really have to get on to back to the guests because we have some phone issues here and feedback loops, and I apologize for that. But let's and by the way, only half of Israel are Ashkenazi Jews; the rest are Arab Jews. But that's neither here nor there right now. The issue of Palestinians and the issue of our history with the Arab world was at the heart of what Ernest was saying.
I agree with you, and here is now they have a right wing president who is. I mean, Prime Minister, who is arrogant, defiant, reckless, and ungrateful to us. But we still support him. The Arab citizenry. They're all watching and hearing the news about that. And what was disgraceful is that President Obama said they have the right to defend themselves. Well, what kind of defense is that? There was very little number of rockets thrown at Israel. Never justified the bombing and the drones attack and the assassination and killing 172 and wounding nearly 400 Palestinians in Gaza in less than a week. That is what the Arab world, and this is why whatever discussion we have, the caller is right, is in the context of our inconsistent and hypocritical policy towards hugging Jordan's King Hussein and the Saudis, and while at the same time we say, well, but Bashar al-Assad is bad or Saddam Hussein is bad, let's take them out to serve our interest. We have no consistent policy.
So, Sam, let me bring you back in and then go to James and Bilal. Do we have Sam?
Yeah, I'm here, Mark.
Go ahead. Did you hear any of that?
I did not hear your question.
So did you heard the caller and you heard what Adil was just saying?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I did hear the caller. And, I mean, I obviously don't agree with him on everything, but I think he had some very good points. I mean, Saddam Hussein was a monster, but he was also an archenemy of al-Qaeda and Islamists. We were actually at one point capturing members of al-Qaeda and turning them back over to Gaddafi because we knew that he would hold them and had no love for them. I mean, that's kind of another sign of what I was talking about before. You know, this is a confused situation with a lot of different factions on different sides, and they don't, you know, at many times it's hard to find whether any of them actually are ones that we feel comfortable with supporting.
And Bilal, let me go to you, then we'll go to James.
I just want to very briefly share a really interesting story with your listeners, Mark, and your guests. And I'm just going to focus on one thing that I disagree with the caller, because it's just more fun. A few months ago, I read quite an absolutely fascinating and controversial piece by a Saudi author who's pretty close to the royal family, arguing, and I'm not being helpful, I don't know where he wrote it, and I can't remember his name, but I'll send it to you as soon as I see it. I saved it on my computer. The man is arguing that, and it's really almost revolutionary, that all the problems that we've been facing and all the suffering that we've endured is not caused by Israel. It is caused by our own leaders, it is caused by our own policies, and by the lack of development, and by just basically harm that we've caused ourselves. And I thought it was just revolutionary. I mean, for someone like him to say that Israel is not the enemy, and that all the harm that we've endured is actually done by our own hands, I thought was fascinating. The caller mentioned that nobody has killed more Arabs and Muslims than the United States. But nobody sees in the news, because that just somehow falls under the radar, how the Iranian leadership basically messes up the plight of the Palestinian people, how they mess up the instability in the region, how dictators basically treat their own people. I mean, this is a story that doesn't get a whole lot of attention. And, of course, it led finally to the Arab Spring. It led finally to the Arab uprising. But for some reason, of course, everybody lasers in and focuses on and the failures of U.S. policy. And we should. I'm not saying we should discount that. But what gets much less attention is how Arabs amongst each other kill themselves, Alawites and Sunnis and Shiites and blah, 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 and all those people, and how the Iranians get involved in the region and also mess up the structure and the stability of the region.
I don't know where you – this is Adil Shimu. I don't know where you get your history, for God's sake. I'm a student of history. History does not agree with you whatsoever. The Shiite and Sunni in Iraq, they have never fought each other since their creation of Iraq. It's only after our invasion there was killing. Yes, there was a third and fourth order, what I call it, differences between the two. But Mark Steiner just told you there were millions of Iraqis intermarried, between 7 million Iraqi Shia and Sunni intermarried. There was 1 million Kurdish Arab intermarriage. There were these problems that existed. I don't claim they don't, but they never boiled to number one where they were killing each other. It only happened after we made the provisional government in Iraq. We constituted it from based on Kurds, Shiite, Sunni, and we give them money and weapons and lands. And that's when the start started.
Let me get a closing thought from James Phillips. We have about 90 seconds left, James. I'm sorry.
Okay, I would just, going back to the caller, he seemed to be trying to blame everything on Israel, but if there's anything that the Arab Spring has taught us is that a lot of conflict in the Middle East does not focus on Israel. And if you want to look at a culprit, I think one of the things that the young people were rebelling against were state-controlled economies, state dictatorships, many of them imposed along the Soviet model or the East European model, Tunisia, secular socialist, Egypt, extremely bureaucratic socialist, and these kind of economies choked off long-term growth and left young people with no way to participate economically or politically. And I think, you know, people that blame this on the U.S. Need to look at the history, because many of these countries, Syria, Iraq, were much more closely patterned on the Soviet bloc than on the West.
You know, Mossadegh in 53 in Iran tried to nationalize their own oil. It belonged to them. We, the CIA and the Brits intelligence services, we killed him and had a coup, and we killed thousands of Iranians.
So we have to leave it at that, and you had the last word for this moment, Adil, and we're going to come back to this, and hopefully our phones will work really well so we can all hear each other and get more callers in here. But I hope you all enjoy this show. I think it was a great conversation. Adil Shamoul, Bilal Sahab, Charles Sam Faddis, and James Phillips, thank you all so much for being part of the show today. I deeply appreciate all your time you've given our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you all. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back from this break, we're switching gears, coming back to Baltimore to talk about the Ravens. Stay with us.